from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Controversies, feuds, and Twitter wars have seemingly become the norm on the national political scene since President Donald Trump took office. On Tuesday, the president referred to recently fired aide Omarosa Manigault Newman as a lowlife and a dog. GOP media and campaign strategist Rick Wilson has been thinking long and hard about how the president has affected his party.
Not every single Trump voter is a racist, xenophobic jerk. Every single racist, xenophobic jerk is a Trump voter.
Wilson joins us to discuss his new book, Everything Trump Touches Dies, and we'll hear where he thinks the Republican Party went wrong and what he hopes is a more optimistic path for conservatism and the country. That's next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. According to recent Gallup polls, 85 to 90% of Republicans approve of the job President Trump is doing, the highest approval numbers of the presidency so far, that is Trump's presidency. And GOP media and campaign strategist Rick Wilson is not one of those people. A founder of the Never Trump movement, Wilson's new book, Everything Trump Touches Dies, offers pointed criticism of how his party has embraced Trumpism, and he presents an alternative path for conservatism in the country. And welcome, Rick Wilson. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I guess I'd like to begin with you with what has become a centerpiece in the news a number of days running now, and that is this controversy centering around Trump advisor, former President Trump advisor, Omarosa Manigault Newman. You're already starting to laugh at this. Why?
Well, I mean, we live in this world now where it's hard to tell where reality TV begins and the presidency ends and vice versa. And she's a perfect example of that. She's an absolute character built by another character.
Well, you have a good deal of comedy running in your work, and we'll get to some of that in the course of this interview. But somebody, I think it was Stephanie Miller, said she was talking about this latest brouhaha with Omarosa Manigault Newman and President Trump, and said, "I don't know where it's like trying to choose between leprosy and Ebola." Does that resonate with you?
Well. Ebola, at least, it kills you pretty quickly. But look, it's the unspeakable in pursuit of the insufferable in this case. And neither one of them, in professional wrestling and reality TV, they have some terms of art that they use. And the bad guy is called the heel in professional wrestling. Well, they're both heels. They're both bad actors. They're both the bad guy.
The president called her a dog. No, I mean,
of course he did.
Well, this is something, of course, that many people are deeply concerned about, that a president of the United States who would campaign and said, no one can be more presidential than I can be, would call somebody, another human being, whatever the circumstances, a dog.
And yet I don't think there's a single American that's been shocked by this. I don't think there's a single American who woke up and went, oh, that is really a huge transgression on Donald Trump's part. That's beyond the pale. I can't believe this dignified, serious man with so much probity and so much respect for others came out and called someone a dog. I'm shocked. Yeah, no one said that waking up the other day.
Well, he's used the word many times, actually. In fact,
he has.
There were a number of African-Americans who said he probably wanted to use, I don't know if you can surmise this, but the B word, but somehow held back on his tweet. But he doesn't hold back on his tweets. And I read an article you did in Rolling Stone where you said that the tweets are probably going to undo him.
I think that, Donald Trump, on the one hand, it's his superpower because he's got 50 plus million followers on Twitter. It bypasses every other media outlet. It allows him to send a set of marching orders to his supporters, both in the grassroots and in the Trump-centric media. And they pick up that ball and they run with it every time. On the flip side, it's like giving a toddler a chainsaw. It's an incredibly powerful tool. And at some point, though, there's going to be a really bad outcome. And on the legal side, a lot of Trump's tweets about the investigation by Robert Mueller and the investigations into the behavior of the Trump campaign and Paul Manafort and Trump's son and other Trump campaign staff officials in regards to Russia and other matters, he's out there tweeting, and it's like he's got a sign pasted on his back that says, "Kick me, I'm obstructing justice."
You were a very diehard Republican. I mean, you were a loyal troop leader in many ways and high up in the hierarchy of the Republican Party. And in fact, now you talk about the id being out of the cage of the Republican Party, the id being, of course, Donald Trump, and talk about it as a very dark time for Republicans. And you even go back to Gingrich, as many people do when they talk about Republican culpability. Can I ask you where you were during those eras when all this was in the cage?
Well, look, I was a guy who went out first on the campaign side and then later on the super PAC side and elected Republicans in, I guess we did work in 38 states over the years. And I've done a lot of national campaign work, and I've done everything from presidential races down to dog catcher and helped try to elect people who were broadly conservative and to help elect Republicans in places not only where it was easy, but in places where it was difficult. So, I mean, we elected a Republican governor in Vermont four times in the 2000s, which was not an easy lift at the time. And, you know, I grew up doing campaigns in Florida, which is the classic purple state. And you can't play, you know, a top-down political monoculture that comes from the Republican mothership in a lot of these places. I was the media consultant, and my partner and I made ads for Rudy Giuliani in 1997 for his reelection and then for his Senate race in 2000. And in those cases, you know, you couldn't the Republican running in New York cannot be like the Republican who runs in Alabama or Georgia. And the Republican running in Washington State can't be like a Republican running in South Carolina. So I helped a lot of folks get elected. I helped a lot of super PACs and associations and political interest groups support their folks and support people that they wanted to see in office. And I had a skill set. You know, it's the Liam Neeson joke, but I have a very particular set of skills. And I made some of the most, you know, famous or infamous negative ads out there. And I was as I say in the book, I was a gleeful hatchet man for my party for a very long time.
You were working in the traditional Lee Atwater and people like that. Is it safe to say?
You bet I was. And you know, Lee Atwater was the chairman and the campaign manager of the first big campaign I was in. I was a field director for George H.W. Bush in 1988 for a big chunk of Florida.
But this has become the party of Donald Trump. I mean, 85 to 90% GOP approval within the party mm-hmm. ranks of Donald Trump.
Well, there are two things to remember in that. The first thing is they're looking at a shrunken Republican Party. We have largely lost women, particularly college-educated women. We've largely lost college-educated voters. They're drifting away very quickly from the Republicans, according to all of the, you know, the exit polling and the survey work we've seen from the special elections in 2017 and 2018. This is no longer a party with a broad base. It is now a party with an increasingly narrow base. You know, we've written off as a party, in order to adopt Trumpism, there are always sacrifices. And so we have adopted this set of policies and attitudes and behaviors that emulate and imitate Donald Trump. And so you do that, you have to be willing to give up Hispanic voters. You have to be willing to give up African-American voters. You have to be willing to give up suburban women voters. You have to be willing to give up a lot of college-educated voters. So if the party is still showing these 85% approval ratings for Trump, it's a party that's shrunken. It's a party that's become much more you know, if you were to do a demographic thumbnail of the Republican support for Donald Trump, imagine every white dude in the country over the age of 50 who has a GED or a high school education. And there you go. That's Donald Trump's Republican Party.
Well, you also have some educated people who, I mean, you talk about Trump supporters as zombies and, you know, Hillary Clinton talked about them as deplorables. But there are people who say, look, the economy is humming and we have made inroads against the treaty or the deal with Iran, which we didn't agree with. We've got two conservative judges that are of high profile and certainly good for the conservative cause. I mean, you do hear those arguments, don't you?
Look, I hear those arguments a lot. And I will tell you, one of the big arguments we hear about the economy is that by some miracle, Donald Trump has caused the economy to just blossom after years of being in the doldrums. About 10 years ago, after the crash, the Federal Reserve decided they were going to juice this economy with a gigantic gout of quantitative easing and basically injecting free money into the system. We did that for about 10 years. And that had a very strong stimulative effect over time. Barack Obama saw a lot of quarters like that were 4.1 that were much like the current quarter. And Republicans were screaming their heads off. Oh, my gosh, we're spending our way into oblivion. We're taking on all this debt. We can never pay it back. Well, they're doing the same exact thing now and still holding on to the stimulative effect of QE. They've passed a couple of gigantic budget busting and deficit expanding bills for the funding bills. They've passed a tax bill that has nice stimulative juice in the economy. It's a nice little short-term sugar rush, but it's going to cost us $2 trillion that we don't have.
So what's happened to fiscal restraint? What's happened to free markets? What's happened to all those conservative values? They've gone down the drain.
Those are completely gone now.
And I free mean, trade.
Republicans, yeah. Free trade is one of the highlights of it. And the president just tweeted a few minutes ago. He said, tariffs built this country. And I'd be hard pressed to come up with a less economically sound assertion about our country. Tariffs did not build this country. Tariffs have almost wrecked this country's economy a couple times. I mean, Smoot-Hawley was a utter disaster for this country. You know, you could draw a through line to the Depression to tariffs rather easily. And so this president, he does not understand this economy, but he hates free trade.
So my listeners may not know what Smoot-Hawley is. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Well, the 1920s trade and tariff bill. And Trump is trying to go back to this era of centralized control over government trade and centralized control over how companies can build their products. So when he goes out and browbeats Carrier or Ford and says you can't build X or Y in Canada or Mexico or Thailand or Tanzania, he's stepping in the economy and doing a direct intervention in the economic decisions of the free market and of individual firms that are behaving legally and that are pursuing profit for their shareholders and pursuing economic benefit for themselves and their workers. And, you know, I was told rather a few times that when Barack Obama decided we were going to promote green energy firms like Solyndra, that was picking winners and losers. Well, now Donald Trump is trying to pick winners and losers in the economy. And by passing these tariffs, he's hoping to force these companies to bring all their workers and all their jobs and all their manufacturing capabilities back to the U.S. You know what? And if you're a nationalist, maybe that makes sense. But if you live in the actual world we really live in, with a global economy, with a flat supply chain around the world, with just-in-time delivery, with specialized manufacturing in different parts of the world, it doesn't work. You know, the romance of we're going to go back to coal mining and steel mills and ironworks, as Steve Bannon famously said, you know, it's a kind of a cruel nostalgia. It's not going to work. It never works. Trade wars like this never work. But we were going to have one because Donald Trump's ego is invested in it.
Talking to veteran Republican media strategist Rick Wilson, author of a new book called Everything Trump Touches Dies. And since you're talking about not being able to go back, I want to really pin this down with you, because there have been a number of Republicans, traditional Republicans, lifetime Republicans, Max Boot comes to mind, Michael Gerson, you, who have said maybe with these midterms, Republicans ought to not only think twice, but perhaps be spurred on to vote for Democrats.
Well, you know, a lot of different folks in the Never Trump side have, you know, I think we all come with a slightly different approach to the 2017 or the 2018 midterms. And, you know, in a perfect world, the Republican Congress would treat its oath to the Constitution seriously. They would treat themselves as a co-equal branch of government and not as if they are a bunch of eager young junior managers at a Trump gift shop at one of his golf courses. They have utterly abandoned any sort of accountability for this president. They have utterly abandoned any sort of moral responsibility to their own constituents in order to please and to keep this president out of their hair. And so I think that we're in a situation where ironically, in a few places, you can see actual Democrats who are to the right of Republicans economically on issues like trade and the deficit, which, you know, I have to, you know, quote the famous film Zoolander and say, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. It's a remarkable position to find yourself in, and looking at certain Democratic candidates and saying, that's actually a person who's a better candidate than a guy whose, you know, main claim to fame is, I love Donald Trump and I want to go wash his car and I've got a beautiful red hat. And so I think that there are people, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody how to vote. I think there are a lot of people who are going to look at it on a case-by-case basis. I think there are Democrats who are running out there who may be giving some of these disaffected Republicans, you know, Republican women, et cetera, enough daylight to say, okay, I can live with this guy. This isn't, you know, this person isn't a crazy. He's not out on the fringe. He's not out on the edge. And, you know, my first choice would be a Republican Party that gets back to its economic conservatism and gets back to fiscal discipline and gets back to serving as a co-equal branch of government. But I don't really see a pathway to that right now.
But you know what the sort of signifying of those kind of Republicans, I mean, you call them Vichy Republicans, some of those who have become ever-Trumpers, as I call them. But, you know, the other side, that is the other side that is really behind President Trump now, calls you and the others establishment.
Well, you know what establishments are? They're organizations that know how to do things. There are organizations that understand that management of parties, management of government, management of systems is important. I know we live in this era where everyone thinks, oh, I can watch a YouTube video and I'm an expert. You know, I could watch a YouTube video on being a spinal surgeon and I'm not a spinal surgeon. But a lot of these folks believe that, you know, they see enough ranting from Alex Jones or Mark Levin or any of these other guys on the Trump cheer section. And they think they understand the world around them. They think they understand, you know, they have a sort of hermetic view described by the Trump, you know, worldview of how Washington works, how the country works, and you know, they're just wrong.
Didn't Steve Contis call you the Alex Jones of the left?
Steve Cortez.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
You know, I found that kind of amusing because, you know, as I've said to Steve before, describe something about me that's to the left. Describe a policy I believe in or an area in my philosophical makeup that you would say is to the left. I'm a conservative. I believe in the rule of law. I'm a Burkean. I'm you know, maybe I'm old school and maybe it's old fashioned now, but I don't believe in pursuing radical change at the hands of mobs. That is the fundamental. I mean, that's one of the founding elements of modern conservatism. It was a reaction to the French Revolution and how the mob became lawless and destroyed the things that were contemptible and also the things that had merit. And so, you know, again, maybe that's an old-fashioned way to approach conservatism. Maybe that's something that isn't as fun as Trumpism. But I think it's a genuine way to approach it. I think it's a genuine flavor of conservatism. And again, I believe in the rule of law. I believe in the Constitution. I believe we have a situation or a system where we are supposed to have three co-equal branches of government. The branches of government are not Donald Trump's Twitter feed, Donald Trump, and Fox News. And unfortunately, we have reached a point with the Republican Party, what's left of it, where they are very enamored of this man and mob mentality. They're very enamored of the sort of authoritarian, curious nature of Trump. They like the bossiness. They like the insults. They like the swagger. They like the tweeted threats to people. They really enjoy that. And what they've lost in that is any respect for the fundamental institutional underpinnings of the country. And it's not just the Republican establishment. It's the free press. It's a free economy. It's all the things that Donald Trump really, really dislikes.
Talking again, if you've just joined us, with Rick Wilson. He's the author of Everything Trump Touches Dies. And I had alluded earlier, Rick Wilson, to the fact that you do take on Trump in a style that sometimes maybe almost mirrors in different ways, like a funhouse mirror, some of the, and I know you have fun with it, some of the kind of things that Trump does in terms of, you know, taking people down. Talk about his dead animal hairstyle, and you describe him as a tout with tertiary syphilis. I mean, this is a little bit of Trump tactics, I guess, but it's also, it shows your enmity and it shows your contempt for him. And I have to ask you, has this president done anything good?
I don't think Donald Trump will go down in history as a man where I think he will be in the pantheon of the worst leaders of our time. And you know, I do have contempt for Donald Trump, but it's more I have contempt for what Donald Trump has done to our country. I have contempt for the people that have enabled him to do these things. He is a man who is mainstreaming racial animus. He is a man who is economically destructive. He is a man who, you know, George Washington was the sort of proto-example for all presidents. And George Washington was always very mindful of the fact that this was an office of enormous power, and yet not a king, not an emperor, not royalty. And
he also never told a lie, allegedly. I'm sorry.
Every president since Washington tried to live by that stature question, that aspect of presidential dignity, that belief that the Oval Office and the White House and the presidency itself were a trust. And Donald Trump looks at these things as something to aggrandize his ego or something to line his pockets. And so I think that it's very hard for me to look at the coincidental and incidental and ephemeral things. So look, maybe
is a tax break incidental or ephemeral? Because they keep bringing up, you know, tax reform. And
no, the tax break is actually a giant economic disaster in the making. And I am a Republican, and I am a low tax guy across the board. But that's the problem. I believe in lower taxes across the board. This tax bill gave consumers and middle-class families a very temporary tax cut that was actually de minimis in the overall number that was issued. And it gave corporations a very large tax cut with this fallacious expectation they were going to create a billion jobs and they were going to do all this investment in their plant and equipment and technology and everything else. They used it to buy back their stock. This is crony capitalism writ large.
Rick Wilson, I have to interrupt because we're coming up on a break, but I want to talk with you also about where conservatism ought to go, what it should stand for, especially since maybe it can't go home again. What can the right rally behind? And I'd like to hear from our listeners. In fact, listeners especially like to hear from some Bay Area Republicans. How do you view your party's relationship to the president, and how would you like the GOP to respond to President Trump? And you may have questions or comments in general for Rick Wilson, the author of Everything Trump Touches Dies. Join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls and involvement in the program. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post anything you'd like there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. When we return, we'll talk more with Rick Wilson and we'll hear from you. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Rick Wilson, who is a veteran strategist and GOP campaigner and who played a very significant role in the upper hierarchy of the Republican Party, and a media strategist would be probably the best way to characterize the work he did. He's author now of a book called Everything Trump Touches Dies. The subtitle is A Republican Strategist Gets Real About the Worst President Ever, and talking with him about a range of issues and certainly welcoming your involvement in the program. Again, let me give you the toll-free number if you'd like to join us, though most lines are full now. You can grab a line when it becomes available at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. You can also, of course, join us by going to our Facebook page. I want to get your thoughts on going back or regaining ground or moving forward. But before I do that, those who would be in the ever Trump category would be people, for example, who are pro-life. And, you know, I can remember when Donald Trump was in favor of abortion, but now he's come off as certainly being a strong supporter of the evangelicals and those who are certainly not in favor of abortion or call themselves pro-lifers. And I wonder how you see this in the bigger picture. I mean, if you have to credit the president with winning over votes and all that, you also have to credit him with siding with certain factions in the country who have a great deal of sway and who also, in many people's minds, make sense in their positions.
I don't underestimate Donald Trump has a certain amount of sort of animal political guile and is willing to compromise people and pitch them and calm them into supporting him. And, you know, I've seen enough candidates over the years in when you had Republican candidates running in purple or blue areas and evangelicals were pulling their hair out saying, oh, he's not pro-life enough. He's not strong enough against gay marriage. And you'd look at them and say, well, first off, you know, no matter how you feel about these issues, you can't win in this or that district with those positions. And it didn't matter to them back then. You had to be right. You had to be on the, you had to be 100% pro-life and 100% opposed to gay marriage, 100% opposed to gay adoption, all these things. Now, those were never my personal positions, by the way. That's a different story for a libertarian discussion. But with Donald Trump, we have a man who is a reprobate in every possible way.
He, you actually call him a grifter. I mean, that's quite a strong word.
He's a grifter. That's me being nice. But Donald Trump is a man who is a serial adulterer. I mean, the evidence is going to slowly keep unfolding from all these, you know, NDAs from the girlfriends and the Playboy models and the strippers and God knows what else. And, you know, those were things that, you know, we had sort of drilled up a lot of that stuff in the 2016 and 2015 window because it's all out there. It wasn't a huge secret. And evangelicals were saying, you know, it's not Hillary. She's the demon from hell and we must destroy her. And so we'll make any compromise. We'll do anything to make sure it's not Hillary. But once it wasn't Hillary anymore, they never looked back and said, okay, Don, now you need to meet some standards of behavior that reflect the values that we hold. And I think that it's a mutually reinforcing arrangement between the evangelicals and Trump. Listen, I don't think Trump is pro-life personally. I would bet you some solid money that he's probably our first president to pay for an abortion. And I think he is a man without a set of values based in any kind of, you know, actual Christian theology, much less the evangelical right. But those people wanted their outcomes from the president. And I, as a conservative, I don't want social engineering outcomes delivered by either a left-wing president or a right-wing president.
Well, you say in your book that the Democrats have been pretty weak, too. I mean, particularly—
Sure, of course.
And a corrupt system with the financing and all of that. So maybe mm-hmm. a pox on both their houses. But, you know, you've been so long and loyal involved in the Republican Party and Republican politics and have understood it as an insider that I have to ask you, how do you get back to not only conservative values that you've been presenting here that you obviously have strong convictions about or believe in, and not only go back to that, but go back to a different standard? I mean, we're on a totally different standard now in terms of, it's a new norm. The kind of things that have come out of this president, the things that he said, the things that he's tweeted and so forth, just with respect to civility or decency or shamelessness, can't go home again, Thomas Wolfe said many years ago.
Yes, he did. And I don't know that as a party we can go home again. If you're going to have a party that's defined in part or whole by conspiracy theory lunacy, by at least the tacit acceptance of racially informed feelings like the alt-right possesses inside the party, you know, the both sides problem. And if you're going to have people who don't believe in any of the sort of fundamental, you know, rule of law or the constitutional, you know, bounds on the power of the executive, I don't know if you go home from that. And I don't think that Trumpism is really as viable without Trump as a lot of these folks believe.
All right, let me get our callers on here. A lot of people want to talk to you, Rick, and we'll start with Trina.
Let's do it.
Join us. Hi, Trina.
Yes. I'm a huge fan, Rick. I see you. I watch you on CNN, and I bought your book. It's not only really enlightening, it is so hilarious. I can't recommend it highly enough.
He should have been a comedy writer, Trina. Would you agree with me?
Oh, my gosh. I'm just so excited to be talking to you. I wish I could meet you. So my question is...
Well, I'll be out in San Francisco doing a book signing here in the next few weeks. I'll let you know.
Do you know where that's going to be? You might as well...
You know what? I don't have that yet. They put it on my calendar, and I don't have that in front of me right now. It just came in today.
Go ahead, Trina.
I'm definitely out on the West Coast, and I will keep you guys informed on the Twitter machine.
Okay, great. I'm in Santa Rosa. So what I wanted to ask you is, I used to be a Democrat, and then the Democrats went way too far left for me. So now I am not affiliated with any party. And I was wondering, have you ever considered punishing the Republicans and Trump by leaving the Republican Party and just going non-affiliated, just being an independent?
You know, I have definitely thought about that. And, you know, I've worked against two Republicans in my career. The first one was Donald Trump, where I helped do the communications and strategy for Evan McMullen's independent bid for president. And the second time I worked against a Republican was against Roy Moore in Alabama. And, you know, I got to say, the Roy Moore race was one of the most liberating moments in my political career. Because you know what I did? I got to use the skill set that I developed over a long time of making brutal, campaign-ending, you know, absolutely bloodthirsty negative ads and turning it against a bad person. And so, you know, there—
A bad person who was supported by President Trump, we should add.
Well, yeah. And you know what? But I would have done it if Roy Moore— was the nominee in Alabama and Jeb Bush was president, I would have still gone after him. But I'll tell you the difference between Roy Moore and Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or even Ted Cruz or anybody and Donald Trump. They would have deployed the power of that establishment of that Republican Party early to kill off Roy Moore's candidacy. Just like George Bush 41, when David Duke ran in Louisiana, deployed Lee Atwater's GOP to go and kill off David Duke on the Republican ticket and support Edwin Edwards, you know, vote for the crook, it's important.
Vote for the crook.
Because they recognized the bigger game. It wasn't just about one single election. It was about the character of the party going forward. And so, you know, there are some days I jokingly say, you know, I'm still a Republican because, you know, that way I can be an extended middle finger to a lot of these people who have thrown away everything they claim they believed in to support this president.
Yeah, notice the cover of your book. It's the other finger, the index finger that you put up in the air here. But there's a couple of tweets here that are apropos, and I'll go to more calls in just a moment. Charles tweets, let's say you're running media strategy for the Democrats in 2020. How do you convince independents to vote against Trump while keeping the Democrat base excited? And I would add to Charles' question the fact that it's pretty clear that the Republicans in the midterms are using the immigration issue, despite what Stephen Miller and the others have wrought with kids in cages and the like. It seems pretty clear at this point that that's going to be, especially to get more people voting for Trump, the ongoing issue. Your thoughts?
Look, both parties have a certain degree of a white-hot ideological base that blackmails the center. And the base says, if you don't give us every single thing we want, we're going to stay home. We're going to take our toys and go home. If the Democrats were smart, and I see some signs that they're actually doing this out in the field this year, not everywhere, they would let their candidates have a little bit of running room. And so if you've got a guy like a Connor Lamb, you don't force Connor Lamb to take on the Nancy Pelosi position on every single issue. You let them have their head. You let them be people who say, I'm going to represent this district. I'm going to do things for the people of this district. I'm going to tackle the economic inequality we're facing. I'm going to tackle the fact that, you know, maybe Obamacare wasn't perfect, but what's happened now is raised your premiums even more. I'm going to get things done for you. I'm going to stop the corruption in Washington and the greed in Washington, because Donald Trump didn't drain the swamp. He deepened the swamp. And you give them some room to be representative of their districts and states.
And we're going to keep hearing that name, Nancy Pelosi, who, of course, is the congressional representative of this district.
And people think, he's going to bring up Nancy Pelosi because he hates women. It's nothing to do with the fact that she's a woman. I used to make the same ads about Harry Reid because he tested horribly with Republican voters. He made Republicans get excited and turn out. So you will see a lot of Nancy Pelosi ads this fall, not because they're right or truthful, but because they go after the Republican base and put the fear back into them.
You don't think misogyny is a factor in all the hatred of Hillary or the hatred of Pelosi?
I will tell you that the liberal nature of Pelosi scares Republicans more than the fact that she's a woman.
Let me get some more
callers. She comes across for Republican base voters. I'm not saying this is true or right. I'm just saying what the political ground truth is. And these people believe this. They believe it. Therefore, it's true for them that she's going to take their guns and force them to get Sharia gay married or some other ridiculousness.
We got Theodore, who wants to talk to you next. Theodore, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, gentlemen, this is a great show. First of all, let me put the cards on the table. I voted for Donald Trump because I just could not tolerate the thought of Hillary Clinton being the president based on her lack of character. And we saw that on the election night when she, outsourced the job she should be doing to John Podesta. Okay, having said that, I have a little buyer's remorse having voted for Mr. Trump because I'm a George H. Bush Republican. And so these far-right freaks that he correctly described as, the French Storm the Bastille mob crowd is very alarming to me. And so my question for your guest is, does he think that it's very possible that the same way what Jesse Ventura essentially destroyed the Republican Party in Minnesota. Remember, he ran as an outsider, former Navy SEAL, appealed to the fish and game crowd, field and stream crowd, sorry, that he destroyed the Republican Party. Could the same thing happen where this whole thing is a disaster and then every Republican who claims to have voted for him runs for the hills and then the party itself is destroyed and the brand for decades?
I think you basically described the final chapters of my book is, when you break an institution, it's really hard to put it back together. Thomas Kuhn said that individuals change, but institutions don't. And I think right now the Republican Party has become so paralyzed by what it's transmogrified into that it's really hard to look at a path forward that isn't defined by Trump. And that's a bad outcome from the GOP, in my opinion. I don't think that the GOP, if you foreclose talking to younger voters, African-American voters, Hispanic voters, because you're listening to the Stephen Millers of the world or the Steve Bannons of the world, and if you shut out Republican women and college-educated voters because you're constantly engaged in juvenile, petty, tabloid-style fights with NFL players and everyone else, and you close out fiscal conservatives because you're spending money like a drunken sailor, I think it's hard for the party to hang together. I think it's hard to keep it in one direction. And as flawed as the establishment may be, it also has a certain, political homeostasis in it where everybody gets a taste. Nobody gets everything.
Well, you hear the president keep saying almost as much as there's no collusion. You hear him say over and over again, numbers are down in unemployment for African-Americans and Hispanics. And I wonder, we get back to Omarosa in a way here, how much you see Trump at one point in your book, for example, you said he wants anyone darker than a latte deported. How much you see him as really, I use the R word here, as a racist. And I raise that question because I don't know if you are aware of this, and listeners may not be. It's news. It's being Huffington Post wrote about it this morning. There's apparently a picture that Roger Stone, the longtime advisor of President Trump's, advisor during his campaign, put on Instagram where he appears in these spacesuits, in these astronaut spacesuits. Roger Stone does, along with President Trump and Sean Hannity and many Trump supporters. And there's a swastika there. Now, why would Roger Stone put something like that on Instagram? I mean, it's kind of enigmatic to me, and I don't have the answer to that. But There are people who say Trump is a fascist, Trump is a racist, and so forth. And yet I'm looking at tweets here, for example, from another listener of ours who says, your guest claims to be a Republican. What about the Supreme Court picks from Trump?
Well, let's cover the race question first. And unfortunately, I think you look at the totality of Donald Trump's public-facing life, stretching back to the fact that he joined his father's company, which redlined out African Americans from renting their properties back in the 70s, 60s and 70s. He engaged in a example of egregious modern race baiting when he claimed the Central Park Five were all guilty and needed to be executed. Of course, they were all exonerated later by DNA evidence, but the lives of those guys were completely wrecked. And you've got a guy who was the most famous birther in the country. He was trying to say that Barack Obama wasn't born here. He's a Kenyan Muslim socialist, plant.
Some have said that you were a birther, Rick Wilson. You deny that?
That is absolutely untrue. It is totally untrue. In fact, I was one of the first Republican consultants in 2008 to come out and say that birtherism is dumb politics and it's untrue. And I was very clear about it at the time. There's no doubt about that. I at no point have ever embraced birtherism.
So you've got a record here that you're talking about, a track record.
I have a very long track record.
And no, I'm talking about Trump's track record too, though.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Trump's – yeah. And then you move on to this is a guy who during some of the investigations of his casinos was found that he didn't want black people on the floor of his casinos. He didn't trust them. And Donald Trump may have had Omarosa as a reality TV star – frenemy or whatever, however you want to describe the relationship. I mentee, frenemy, whatever the flavor is. But we're not even going into the distant past. We're looking at the 2016 election where when he's asked, do you denounce David Duke? And he hems and haws and it takes days and days where every single human being with a brain and a spine would have said, of course, he's a scumbag. No, and he belongs in no way in my party. But Duke had said nice things about him. And for Trump, that's hypnotic. He can't look away when someone says nice things about him. We also had the alt-right where Trump was retweeting alt-right accounts all during 16. We've got a lot of people around Trump's circle, Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller, Seb Gorka, who and Michael Anton, who are, to put it generously, alt-right adjacent, because a lot of their policies are directly inflected by race, and Trump embraced those policies. And finally, you've got the icing on a terrible cake, which is Charlottesville, which was an unforgivable, shameful moment in the history of this country. I have trouble processing. I'm angry about a lot of things Trump has done to my party. That was something I think that Donald Trump did to our country, that empowered people who are domestic enemies of our republic and empowered the worst dregs of our society and let them feel like they had somebody who was winking and nodding at them from Washington, from the most powerful job in the country. And the correct response to Charlottesville was easy. There were not good people on both sides. My grandmother used to have a phrase called the turd in the punch bowl. The punch may be delicious, but the minute there's a single turd in the punch bowl, it's all just turd water. And so Charlottesville, I don't care who was there. I don't care if there were historians there protesting the statue coming down for whatever historical reasons. You got Nazis and Klansmen and outriders and white supremacists and violent people who committed a terrorist murder on our soil. And this president couldn't bring himself to sack up enough to say, these guys are scum. They're dirt. They don't belong in our country. I want them named and shamed. These are the worst of our people. And I will do everything I can to bring this country together racially.
Again, we're talking to Rick Wilson, just one of my listeners, Republican media strategist, author of Everything Trump Touches Dies, and we have a lot more callers, so let's get as many as we can. Amy, you're next.
Yes,
I just want to briefly say I grew up in Oakland, but then I spent, and I'm back now living in Woodland, California, but I spent 44 years in the Dakotas. And my question is about the disenfranchisement that I saw, you know, from a lot of rural, poor white people, and particularly men, whom now I think have been sucked into the Donald Trump message. And how can we as a country, rather than getting into the you versus me and us versus them scenario, can we educate them to see where Donald Trump's policies and behavior not only are morally apprehensible, but can we get them to see their denial, to get them to see what we really need as a whole country to get along and work together to make everybody better?
In other words, Amy, you're asking, can education do what needs
to
be?
Is there some way he thinks, now he's trying to educate by writing this book, right, and talking about it, but is there some way that we can kind of get people on to the page of where this isn't the road we want to go down on, including those who feel like they're so disenfranchised that it's okay to say racist, nasty things?
Yeah, how do you get through to the people that she's talking about here? Rick Wilson, some thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you, the pain is the only teacher in politics. And a lot of the people that supported Donald Trump did so because they had a sense of the world had changed around them. They didn't like it. And some of those changes were economic, you know, the famous economic anxiety. And some of those changes were demographic and racial. And some of those changes were the fact that, you know, our country has moved beyond, in some ways, being a labor-based economy and is moving towards being an information and ideas-based economy. All these things have been wrenching transitions. But Donald Trump gave them this cruel sense of nostalgia, this idea that by his, you know, by his executive power and his unique abilities as a CEO and a manager and a negotiator and a leader, they would bring back a different world. They would bring back 1958, that it would be, you know, there'd be a world where the guy who went to high school could go to work at the auto plant and work there for 30 years and retire with a good pension and full health care for the rest of his life. And, you know, and during that period, he'd have enough money to put his kids through college, and he'd maybe even have enough for a bass boat and a weekend house up at the lake. You know, that was a dream that died a long time ago, and it's not coming back. We are in the middle of a very serious economic transition in this country, and people who don't treat it seriously are lying.
And a tweet from Emma that I wanted you to respond to, because it's pretty much along similar lines. It says, please ask your guests where we would be if he and his clients had done what was honest and true instead of work to win at any cost.
Well, politics is a hard game, and we fight on both sides to win. And I make no excuses for the fact that I was a well-compensated and skillful warrior on my side. A lot of the time, we did fight for the right ideas. A lot of the time, we did fight for the uplift, that we did fight for free markets and personal liberty. And, you know, in the course of that, there's some knives out, very, you know, ugly, bloody barroom fights politically. And I don't make excuses for what I did as a consultant. But I in my work, I tried to help elect good people. I turned down over the course of my 30-year career probably a dozen clients over the years who I thought were either edge cases or you know, there was a turd in the punch bowl, or they were in some way, you know, running for reasons that were you know, venal or weird or so ambitious that it was a little frightening. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not making excuses for the work I did. I was very good at it.
I have a friend who is a really intelligent man and who says he voted for Trump because he wanted to shake up the system because he couldn't stand Hillary Clinton. And now he wants to stay behind Trump as much as he can because he feels the integrity of his vote is really what ought to be at risk here in losing. What do you say to somebody like that?
Well, look, I recognize there were a multiplicity of reasons for people who voted for Trump. And the fear of a Hillary was a very large driver in that. And the idea that Trump is going to shake up Washington and reform Washington in some way nobody gains by me soft-pedaling this. It's just BS. It's just not true. And so even though you cast a vote and you want to be proud of that vote and you want to hold up that vote and say, you know, I don't have any regrets. I don't have any second thoughts. I don't have any qualms about this. You're fooling yourself if you think that Donald Trump was the character he played on TV. And a lot of people bought into that.
Were you happy with the two appointments to the Supreme Court that he made as a conservative?
Any Republican president would have given you a Gorsuch or a Kavanaugh. And I say this because I recognize these guys' names from the Federalist Society list. Gorsuch is Mitch McConnell's pick. Donald Trump couldn't have picked out Gorsuch from a lineup. He had no idea who these people were. None whatsoever. He played almost no role in the selection and almost no role in the nomination.
Rick Wilson, we're going to have to close now because unfortunately we're out of time. We could spend a few more hours with you, but I'm just going to read one more tweet here. Carly says, I have a request for Rick Nelson. Please send autographed copies to the following senators: Susan Collins, Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, and Senator Lisa Murkowski. They just need a little extra push to be heroes. Good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
I will do it. Thank you so much.
Rick Wilson, again, is the author of Everything Trump Touches Dies, and we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and we'll be back with you on tomorrow, if all goes according to plan. We're going to talk about women in politics tomorrow. Stay tuned for more here on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.